This is side B of session 59, recorded on March 18, 2008. Now, I wanted to bring up the idea of the resonant interval, or resonant, or resonating. People say, I resonated with something. Usually they mean they tuned into it, in a sense of matched with it. But tactility is, what McLuhan said, the resonating interval. And tactility is neither one side of matching or the other side of making. Or, as I have in my essay, Cloning ESP, it's called Cloning ESP, blocking and merging. So most people, I think, when they say they resonated, they think they've merged with it. But actually, resonant includes the blocking, the fragmentation from the matching or the tuning in, because tactility is oscillating back and forth and in neither position. So resonating really is inclusive of opposite tendencies. Would you agree or admit that that's not what people think when they say they resonated with something?
No, I think, yeah, when people say they resonate with something, I think they're, you know, I got the, you know, I'm vibrating with it.
Yeah.
Wasn't that one of the things in Good Vibrations? And the...
Right. So that when the Internet created not just a global ESP, it created a global fragmentation, global separateness.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the little matrix tube, as well as at the same time totally at one with the same perception. So the oscillating back and forth, or the para back and forth, I mean above, below, beside, inside, omnidirectional, non-directional, is the real meaning of resonance. So on my chart, tiny note chart, in the quadrants, I've got different categories of experience, opposite categories, resonating within the era or quadrant. You see what I'm saying? So I've got disservices like lung cancer. I've got ecstatic experiences like jazz. I've got political paranoias like McCarthyism. I've got great movies like The Great Escape. I've got the God is Dead movement. I've got world government. I've got Macbeth. Macbeth is a Shakespeare play around somebody engaging in a coup, a political coup, toppling the present leader and hijacking the situation. That's what Macbeth is about.
Mm-hmm.
So in the radio environment of the 20s and 30s, there were lots of coups and political paranoia and political assassination squads and takeovers like the Bolsheviks in Russia and the Nazis in Germany and the Mussolini and the fascists in Italy and the fascists in Japan, all over the place, right? These hijacking of parliamentary procedures, which come out of the 19th century. So that's why you have Macbeth as the symbol, and politics becoming a prominent, charismatic institution. So you have the great leaders, supposedly, like Churchill and Roosevelt, Hitler and Stalin and Mao Zedong, and Mao's a little later, but that's because China's less developed, and Mussolini. So you see the resonating nature of the quadrant? There are polarities. There are opposite cultural activities within the effect of radio and are evoked by radio, radio being the ground, right?
Right. Do you ever study Bucky's idea of tensegrity?
Yeah.
You have a sort of flexible object that's where lines or sticks are connected at certain points in the structure, and it has a there are certain polarities which are pushing
push-pull, yeah.
Yeah, pushing parts of, some parts apart, and there's tensions which are pulling other parts together, and the whole thing establishes a kind of an equilibrium. Would you use that as an analogy for resonance?
Well, I agree with McLuhan, who says Bucky Fuller was a 19th century man, but he was at the avant-garde phase of 1840-1900, and he definitely had, with his Bucky domes, the radio experience, the radio meme in mind. He was resonating off it because acoustic space is spherical, and he made a big deal out of the sphere and the tensegrity spheres, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he was taking connected space, the connections within his drawings, and showing their flexibility and adjustability. He was acousticizing the radio tactile effect.
Yeah.
And so he was more of a visual guy, making connections, the triangle as a connected thing, but he broke up the triangle. He made it a resonant gap. Have you ever seen the imagery he worked with? I mean, he made the triangle flexible.
Yeah, to be more specific, he called it vector equilibrium.
Right, and he turned it almost into a spinning phenomenon. So he could make a lot of spinning imagery that resonated with people in the 50s and 60s, but really in the deeper ground was him architecturalizing, visualizing the radio effect, approximating tactility, but applying it to visualizable buildings and structures.
Yeah.
So all of that is a 19th century sensibility.
But he had a humanitarian vision, which, like LaRouche did, does. But his vision was that you could create, you could use technology to create a world that would allow everyone to have abundance, and you would only have to work if you wanted to. And that was a great idea, because instead of having to go to work at Walmart in order to make enough money to eat, you could work or not work. And the idea was that if you had time on your hands, you'd have more time to have percolate a creative idea, something of your own. Then when you went to work on your idea, you'd be working on something that you had a passion for because you wanted to. And so
And he said it might contribute serendipitously,
right,
to society. So what McLuhan said radio did for the fragmented industrial culture was create a mood of the fellow traveler, the idea of the sympathy with communist Soviet Union in the 30s, which was popular among the intellectuals. There was a new appreciation of the group mind or group collectivity cooperation. And so the term that came out of that 30s era was, these people are fellow travelers. That could be a derogatory term, or it could be complimentary. So that Bucky Fuller was expressing the literate man resonating with the group effect of radio, and he would come up with communistic solutions, like put everybody on a guaranteed income and let them create in any way they want to. People at the time would consider Bucky Fuller derogatorily a communist, right?
Right.
But he was an individual inventor, had enough of the individual 19th century creativity and ingenuity, and the Renaissance man of industrial society, that calling him a communist didn't stick, because he had so many other interesting Western characteristics,
mm-hmm.
archetypal characteristics. So Bucky Fuller definitely was a guy whose visions were subsumed into the radio effect.
Yeah, and so how is his vision different from LaRouche's, who archetypalized as the radio effect?
Right. LaRouche, I wanted to emphasize the paranoid element of radio. And LaRouche has a public image of being more paranoid than Bucky Fuller. And Bucky Fuller was a more acceptable establishment personality. And the idea of the LaRouche or the McLuhan or the Thompson, the Croker or the Dobbs, is they're outsiders. They dance on the toes of the of the accepted situation. So the LaRouche, you know, almost unwittingly is a Rumpelstiltskin, and it has the services of a Rumpelstiltskin in relation to technological liberalism, which is what Bucky Fuller was an icon of. So that, and because it's the radio paranoid effect of top-down conspiracies that Mae Brussels documented, that level Bucky Fuller didn't really emphasize till that book he put out in about 1980, you know, The Captains of the Pirates, the 150 Corporate Pirates. You remember what was the name of that book? Critical Path. Anyways, he talks about the pirates hijacking the global village. So in the, quote, conspiratorial, unquote, tendency, he didn't get into that till the end of his career. But LaRouche built a lot on it from his earlier days. So LaRouche is just more controversial, more appropriate to the meaning of the quadrant in the Android meme. Bucky Fuller is someone who is operating before the Android meme. Notice that McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, Croker, myself, we show up during the Android meme, between 60 and 90.
When is Bucky's period?
Well, he gets picked up by Fortune magazine or one of those major, Forbes or Fortune magazine, in the late 30s.
Oh.
And he presents his Dymaxion car in the 30s. He's famous by the 50s. The articles, Life magazine coverage, those kind of things, at least among the educated, maybe more academic world, university world. But he peaked in the, you could say, in the Expo, Montreal Expo in 67 with their the Bucky Fuller Dome, the geodesic dome.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, that's during the Android meme phase, and he was kind of retrieved in the late 60s, early 70s by Stuart Brand and other people after McLuhan was a big figure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people didn't fully get McLuhan, so they fell back on Bucky Fuller. So he started reemerging in the late 60s, early 70s in the revolutionary atmosphere. But he was always being courted by corporations. The point is, he's successful in the 50s.
Yeah. And how does McLuhan memorialize Fuller?
Well, he quotes Fuller in his 50s writing. He was well aware of Bucky Fuller. He doesn't become a correspondent and a friend till 61, 62. I've read some of their letters. I have McLuhan's critique of Bucky Fuller that I got from the National Archives when I was there in August 2004. But let's go back to this quadrant. So now the tetrahedron.
Yeah, so LaRouche. Now, what makes him, why is he the first one in the Android meme here? What makes him Android meme,
he represents an older fashioned sensibility, a 19th century sensibility.
Yeah.
But he redoes it in a new, interesting.
But you're saying that Fuller represented that, but he didn't quite make the Android meme status.
Right. And he's not a controversial character like LaRouche and McLuhan were.
Oh, controversy has something to do with it?
Oh, yeah, because these are Rumpelstiltskins. Remember, the quadrant is the technological liberalism quadrant. The 1840, 1900 industrial, electrochemical industrial era. LaRouche is only one part of this situation. You know what I mean? He's only one syndrome.
Right.
And he's part of the retrieval of that meme in the 60 to 90 period. And he has to be kind of quirky and eccentric and unique and odd to fit in to the human thinker element resonating with Rumpelstiltskin tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
Now you notice the word tetrahedron in that quadrant, right?
Oh, yeah. That's a Bucky.
That's a Bucky Fuller, but it's also LaRouche. He works with tetrahedron. But that is the acknowledgement of Bucky Fuller. That's embedded in there.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of tetrahedron. Now, back in the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, the Western colonial powers would use anthropology to study the third world and fourth world cultures around the world that were contents of their imperial models, imperial attempts. So cultural studies is there as a form of espionage by Western academia and by intelligence agencies, looking at the new cultures that are very different sensibility that they're confronting in the global village. Mm-hmm. Global village begins at the time of the telegraph, which is 1840, 1900, but we're emphasizing the radio effect, a later effect, right? It was hidden ground in the 19th century, becomes ground in the first half of the 20th century. So cultural studies is a discipline that fits the imperial phase of Western knowledge. And LaRouche is like a cultural student. He goes around and analyzes he's got a huge inventory he's built up through the years, his group. They study the political history of, say, the 1700s to the 1900s of all kinds of nations all over the world. And they project the American system advocates within those different nations. So it's a politically biased and determined form of cultural studies. It's a unique form of cultural studies. It's a programmed cultural studies. Mm-hmm. And that's why LaRouche is in there, to resonate with the nominalism in the cultural studies. Remember, LaRouche is anti-nominalism, very anti-nominalism.
Oh, yeah. So there's a in the resonance of the monad column, there's a polarity there between LaRouche and nominalism.
Yeah, the monad, not the monad column, the monad quadrant.
Quadrant, yeah.
Because it's under Eloy or under Hadron, you have LaRouche versus nominalism.
Yeah.
So you could make a Bucky Fuller tensegrity sphere out of each quadrant. You could have a tension, have a connection from LaRouche to nominalism, over to cultural studies, to jazz. Remember, LaRouche is against jazz, too.
Mm.
So that the tension, the sticks of connection, and the push-pull thing that the buckyball illustrates, or his form of geometry, can be represented with the factors in the quadrant, right? Because you got this tactile tension going on, this push-pull.
Right, and a net, the net result would be an equilibrium of some kind.
Yes, yeah, an ecology. And, like, LaRouche is not that keen on sports, so there's a tension between him and Mickey Mantle. He's definitely not keen on Time magazine. And Time magazine represents the unified nationalist culture in the electric age.
Hmm. Why doesn't he like Time magazine?
Because it's run by the British intelligence via Henry Luce, the guy who took LSD.
Hmm.
And popularized all this folk culture stuff that LaRouche is against. So LaRouche is like Platonic. He believes there's a higher culture. He's not into mixing it up with pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a detachment there, a visual space legacy, a hierarchical detachment. So he represents the visual kinetic bias against the proprioceptive osmic acoustic. But what makes LaRouche interesting is that if you read his philosophy in depth, he'd be able to defend himself against my categories, because he's not following the traditional Platonic view. He's not following the traditional Aristotelian view. It's totally eccentric what he comes up with. But eccentric is what's necessary in the Android meme phase. You've got to rewrite history and come up with a bizarre angle that attracts almost cult-like involvement.
Hmm.
Right?
Would it be too in-depth of a question to ask how he differs from Aristotle and Plato? Or Socrates?
Any scholar, any traditional Platonic professor would follow, I think his name is Benjamin Jowett, the 19th century British translator of Plato, the text for academia. And LaRouche goes and exposes how limited and erroneous Jowett is. In other words, most normal academic courses in Plato or Aristotle would not say that Aristotle assassinated Alexander the Great. Okay? That's what LaRouche says.
Well, that sounds like not a philosophical bias, but some kind of a political bias.
That's right. The politician speaking. The politician invading cultural studies. Now, LaRouche, though, knows that in the global implosion of the Android meme phase, that one person like Henry Kissinger can be the trigger man for the whole planet. LaRouche is up against Kissinger as a candidate to be the global trigger man.
Yeah, how come you don't have Kissinger on there?
He's implied, but we don't have everybody on the chart.
Right.
But definitely he's implied by LaRouche being there, because Kissinger said, supposedly, LaRouche is persecuting me. So the whole LaRouche world is evoked by the name Linda LaRouche, and there are references to his system throughout. For example, in the Rye Eloy Too Lofty Bob quadrant, meaning going across horizontally, you've got circle, hyperbola, ellipse, parabola, cone torus. Those are references to LaRouche geometry.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Those are references to geometry, but LaRouche has his own spin on those things.
Yeah, it's his unique spin.
And they have to do with original observations of probably the night sky or something.
Right, and they are part of knowledge from 2,000 years ago. Modern mathematics and geometry doesn't use those terms.
Well, yeah, they do. Those are legitimate geometrical terms.
Oh, yeah, they're used, but they're not taught the way LaRouche demands that his students go through and relearn what's called the constructive geometry experiments.
He's doing the etymology on those terms.
That's right, doing the etymology. Modern students, how do they learn? Through computer graphics. I don't know what they learn. They learn, though, modulating and simulating when they deal with geometry. And not that that's wrong, but certainly it's not popular from LaRouche's point of view. Not a good service, a useful service. You produce bad economists, bad mathematicians, if they don't go through the original constructive geometry that Plato laid out.
Yeah, so he thinks that they refer to a deeper reality.
Right. And so when you read his philosophy and his interpretations of Plato, there are grains of acceptable terminology, but where he takes it. In other words, he says basically that one of the things he says, I guess, is that a proper understanding of Plato would make you a person who would run for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
That's a political movement.
Yeah.
Now, Plato is known on the cliche level as the advocate of the philosopher king. I don't know if Plato would advocate people to get politically involved.
Mm-hmm.
But then Plato wasn't part of the era of the industrial bureaucracy, which is what Parliament and Congress is.
Yeah, so LaRouche is saying if Plato was alive today, this is what he would be advocating.
Yeah, and modern philosophy departments probably definitely don't consider the categories of Plato.
Mm-hmm.
They consider that a limited. They'd study Plato as a cultural studies, as an anthropology, and they would come up with the modern philosophies like Wittgenstein and which are non-philosophies from LaRouche's point of view, and Aristotelian perversions and heresies and the worst thing to be, existentialist. They look too much to the structure of things. And that's the Aristotelian method, or the grammarian method, and from McCune's point of view, and LaRouche is a dialectician who believes that thought is the ground of everything.
The Aristotelian is relying on sense perception to inform his knowledge.
So that, you know, Plato is an anti-environment to that. Now, LaRouche, if you can accept, well, what he's trying to do, he actually is more modern than the teachers of philosophy in academia or the existentialists, because he is hijacking the modern media to create a, quote, cult to stir up political conspiracies all over the planet. He does act out what he states Plato's about, and he's not teaching it like a professor and just being an academic bureaucrat. He's out there in the streets.
Yeah.
So he's a retrieval of that Platonic sensibility, which would be more relevant in the 19th century. And because he's part of a meme that's being retrieved by the Android meme of the 19th century and the hidden ground of radio, he goes in that quadrant. And he has charisma, which is another point of the Android meme from the point of view of this chart in 1995, is showing these different spirals of the past,
you know,
having equal audiences or equal charisma.
So to be more exact, the Android meme is creating a mood in which a LaRouche can thrive.
Yeah.
LaRouche couldn't thrive in another era.
Right. He's creating a mood or a tensegrity sphere, that's what the Android meme's doing, or a bacterial niche. And you'll see the references to that level of classification in the top part with Roy, Eloy, Tu, Lofty, and Bob. You have
bacterial niche. You mean like an entire organism?
That's right. But very tiny. But part of an ecology, just like the subatomic particles hadron is, and the meson, you have up above there, you have prokaryotic cells, anaerobic bacteria, cyanobacteria, eukaryotic cells, and then Acacia. LaRouche is like a prokaryotic cell.
Hmm. In what sense? Those are all prehuman.
Well, once you get the eukaryotic cell, you have the unicellular division, which then allows reproduction and sexual reproduction. The two phases before that, prokaryotic and anaerobic, are self-reproduction. They split among themselves, right?
Asexual.
Asexual. There's no sex involved. So LaRouche represents an asexual phase, pre-sexual. And that's to show almost the primitiveness of his time zone of the 19th century, 1840 to 1900, and the primitiveness of radio.
But that's not a comment on his thoughts about sexuality.
No. It's about his remoteness compared to later developments of Thompson and Croker zones,
mm-hmm.
like the chip body. He's dealing with the chemical body. He actually quotes his guru, the counter Teilhard de Chardin. Chardin's idea of the noosphere, he counters that with Vernadsky, the Russian concept of the noosphere, which is a biogeochemistry notion of the noosphere. So notice the word chemistry in there, biogeochemistry. So Vernadsky is more aligned to a chemical body vision that LaRouche is building on. But LaRouche is not limited to the chemical body nomenclature that modern science and genetics uses.
Hmm.
He does not limit himself to what he calls pairwise particle oppositions, like the electron versus proton. He doesn't go with those. Now, that's really primitive, right?
No.
For most people, because those are grand assumptions that modern knowledge and the chemical body knowledge builds on. LaRouche doesn't acknowledge them.
So if LaRouche looked at your chart, he'd go, "Oh, this chip body, TV body stuff is all trash. It all has to do with the chemical body. That's the source, and that's what we need to look at."
But not the chemical body as modern science defines it. He would look at anything like my chart that indicates phases.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't believe in evolutionary phases, at least evolution as presented in phases like the Romantic era, the pop culture era, the abstract expression era, the Cubist era. He doesn't believe in dividing history into those phases because he says the Platonic principles are eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's constantly a battle between being and becoming, or a complementarity, so that...
So the cultural phases are just superficial stuff, surface
right.
stuff.
Yeah, he called it rhetorical fluff and Aristotelian fluff and surface-mannered sense embedment.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the larger issues are always us versus the oligarchs. That's what every major movement or action in history is, and you just replay that. Well, keep it going.
We talked with Worcester last night. He talked about you got the power grabbers and the managers. The managers are being of service to the ecology. The power grabbers are just trying to hoard it, you know, get it all for their own ego needs.
So LaRouche resonates with Macbeth because he's pretending to be a, this is the negative interpretation of LaRouche, which a lot of people have, he's pretending to be a manager against the Macbeth who's hijacked the world, the power grabbers like Kissinger, but he's confronting them as a fellow power grabber. He's like a Macbeth who wants to take over and knock off the previous power grabbers, all, he said, in a more intelligent ecological sense of management.
Right. In metaphysics, you have this idea of the White Lodge and the Dark Lodge, and they almost go like all the way back to Source, as though Source split itself into good and evil in a way. And but I bet LaRouche doesn't look at it in those terms. He just sees good people who've been corrupted, but there's no intrinsic, you know, Dark Lodge or something like that.
Right. He wouldn't want to get stuck in the Gnostic split or Manichaeism. But many people see him, his image is Manichaean.
When what's Manichaean again?
Manichaean is the idea that there is a battle between good and evil, and that they cancel each other out. They're equally strong.
Yeah.
So they would see Plato as almost a Gnostic, Manichaean sensibility, trying to rise above a fallen world. The way LaRouche puts down all the normal institutions, like Harvard, it's almost a Gnostic Manichaean sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that we're looking at the ecology of the LaRouche quadrant. Now we could shift, since you hope to do each quadrant in.
Well, no, I think I don't think we're going to do that. I think we should continue with LaRouche until we finish it, and might take this a little longer.
Yeah, but I want to show you how since. We create a resonance between the quadrants. I think now that you see how I'm interrelating the parts of the LaRouche quadrant.
But there are important elements here in the LaRouche quadrant we haven't touched on.
Yeah, but we'll get
to get a full understanding before we start comparing quadrants.
Well, it's easy to compare the quadrants because the next quadrant, the categories, now that I've explained the relationships, are repeated in the next quadrant under a different ground.
Right.
And that shouldn't be hard to understand.
Yeah, but
so
we don't know what the number 7 means in LaRouche. When we know that, it'll be easier to know what the number 22 means when we get to the...
Yeah, but we'll get to that by contrasting and comparing with the 22 of the McLuhan Quadrant.
All right.
So, for example, we go into the McLuhan Quadrant, which is actually more titled by the phrase oleopathic television / satellite. McLuhan is just one segment of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
One aspect. So what you see is that I go from Macbeth to King Lear. Why would McLuhan be King Lear? Well, you see that he's no longer in the God meme, he's in the sex meme, right?
Yeah.
McLuhan is oleopathic television satellite mace on triad sex.
King Lear's the guy who goes mad and betrays his daughter and his family and unwittingly ends up, you know, broken and dies a broken man.
Right. And McLuhan represents the literate sensibility and the most advanced literate sensibility. He mastered Finnegan's Wake, which is a real challenge for any literate person. And so he's the king of the humanist literate tradition, confronting what's happening to his family and his children under the effect of television. Okay.
That's a good one. Do you think LaRouche would? Do you think McLuhan, if he were here alive today, would be able to relate to himself in that position?
What do you mean?
You're characterizing him that way. I wonder if he would go, yeah, that's how I felt.
Yeah. Now the thing is that some people would say LaRouche is a neo-Nazi fascist. Negative Macbeth kind of guy trying to bring in a coup. There's a whole book written by Dennis King on LaRouche is that way.
What was the Macbeth story in a nutshell?
There was a king, and he wanted to topple the king. So he conspired to knock off the the local king and become king himself.
Oh, so on that level, it's all political intrigue.
That's right. That's why he's in the politician quadrant.
Right.
And the radio era was a great era of intrigue, and that's the Orwellian world of Big Brother. That's what was built in the first half of the 20th century under radio. Television glossed over that and created a whole other level of, we could call it, friendly Big Brother.
Why do we associate Big Brother with the radio? Was one-way broadcasting. They didn't really have any way to spy on you. They just had a way to talk to you.
And that's what Big Brother is. It's a one-way propagandic controlling of the public mind through newspeak.
Well, no, Orwell's idea was, you know, if you excuse me for saying so, more futuristic. Big Brother, there was a screen in everyone's house, and they were watching you and propagandizing to you.
That's right. It was a tactile projection of the effects of electricity, but the idea was that the empire was, the global village was divided up into three zones, and the Big Brother ran all three zones, but pretended there was wars between them, and hoiked up rebel figures, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The way LaRouche is hoiked up by mainstream media as a rebel, enemy of the people. So Orwell's discovering is talking about how newspeak and verbal information and one-way surveillance, that situation is the effect of radio. Radio is participatory, but not as participatory as television, because radio is a hot medium.
Radio isn't surveillance at all. Radio is one-way broadcasting. Surveillance is when you're watching someone.
Well, what do you think happened? When do you think J. Edgar Hoover started? He started in 1924, got going in the 30s. What do you think the Nazis and Gestapo did? What do you think the Stalinists did? There was nothing but surveillance.
Oh, that was through wiretapping. That didn't really have anything to do with the radio, per se.
No, through chemical body surveillance. They would watch what you did and who you talked to. So you had national paranoia in those countries.
What did that have to do with the radio? They probably did that in all times.
No, radio made half the population surveilling the other half. It made a situation where people could see what you're doing and report it by telephone immediately to a news broadcast, and then that would be talked about immediately. In the pre-radio era, you had to write letters. It's a lot slower.
Yeah.
You had to have inquisitions.
Oh, yeah, I see. So there was a linkage there between the telephone and the radio.
Yeah, yeah. And the point is gossip and political alignment and your allegiance to ideology.
The radio could be the condemning voice. If you were a political figure and somebody saw you do something against the state, they reported that, then if the radio announced it, then you were shamed in front of everybody.
Immediately. And so you have, the Big Brother is talking about literate and verbal and image information, not as much image as the television era, but the radio image in effect, how the industrial societies use TV and radio to accomplish industrial uniformity rearview mirror goals.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they had no sense of the discarnate effect and how thought actually was the content of radio. And so they thought that everybody had to think the same thought. They took a 19th century version of the electric tactile ESP and didn't acknowledge the resonating thing that to have a vibrant ecology, you'd have the opposite thought. Now, globally, the managers, the tetrad managers, did have the opposite tactile thoughts represented by the three different political groups or regions in the world. So I think you could see, we could do more into it, but George Orwell's 1984 really described 1934. Now, you could say, well, what about the fact it was after a nuclear war, and what else do you have? Basically, it was nuclear war, which for most people had not happened yet, but it did happen in 1945 in the radio era.
Orwell predicted it in 34?
No, he wrote his book in 48.
Oh, okay.
And then he published it and reversed the date. 48 became 84.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about a period after a nuclear war. I'm recalling it correctly. I haven't read it in decades.
Right.
But people would say, well, the nuclear war hasn't happened yet. They didn't realize that bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima was a nuclear war.
Right.
You know, even though it was tiny.
Well, yeah.
Compared to the image of a global nuclear holocaust. So he was describing the world after 1945, or not 1984, at least 1945 when the bombs were dropped, but the whole political drama of the use of fake political enemies and secret societies and intelligence agencies that carries on in Big Brother is the life under radio in the late 20s and early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually describing the past in 1948 disguised as the future.
And television turns the bombing of Nagasaki into a global holocaust because the images spread globally.
Right, and McLuhan said that television was way more dangerous than the atomic bomb or the hydrogen bomb because it caused psychic damage way beyond the physical damage that the bomb was feared to project.
Right.
So, we look at the middle part, Quark Toon versus automobile. That's a reference to the Bob Dobbs formula chart, right?
Right.
And you'll see in the McLuhan quadrant, it's airplane versus interacting in a tactile resonance with television. We have that in the Nixon quadrant, right?
That's right.
So you have the Kennedy zone from the formula chart, automobile versus Quark Toon in the LaRouche quadrant. Then you have the Nixon zone. Doesn't match up exactly with the dates in the formula chart. I mean, Nixon is 1945 to 1960.
Yeah.
But that interaction, airplane, television, in the McLuhan quadrant is 1900-1918. But it is 1965, which is very close to Nixon's 1968 date. You
mm-hmm.
see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So now we have Eros and Periodic in the LaRouche quadrant. Eros, Chaos, Gaia, Orpheus, and Prometheus. The first four are variations of the role of Isis, the complementary mythic image, iconic image to Rai, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have in brackets besides Eros, Periodic. That is the simple attractor dialectic, like the periodic pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
Going back and forth.
Right.
And then it gets a little more chaotic.
So that's like the clicking, ticking of the clock. It,
right.
It implies time, linear
right.
time.
Linear time, and then you have the Time magazine there.
Mm-hmm.
Space has not taken over in the way McLuhan uses space
mm-hmm.
versus time. So the simple periodic attractor, think of Eros as a simple male-female dialectic, right?
Yeah.
It gets a little more blurry and becomes chaotic in the tactile quadrant of McLuhan
mm-hmm.
or of television. Let's see. Now
although chaos theory probably doesn't become popular until the late 70s.
Right. Now, the you got Ezra Pound in the LaRouche quadrant because definitely LaRouche replays the conspiracy theories of Ezra Pound, maybe not as crudely as Ezra Pound, but
in what respect? Ezra Pound was a bit of a I think we looked at this once before. He was a bit of a fascist.
Yeah, he was considered anti-Semitic because he blamed the World War One and Two on the international bankers,
yeah,
which back then was considered the Jewish bankers.
Yeah. And LaRouche, although we don't consider him anti-Semitic per se, probably does still think that the international bankers are a problem.
Yeah, and Ezra Pound, got on the radio in Italy,
mm-hmm.
broadcast during World War II, which made him be charged with treason at the end of the war.
Yeah.
So what you actually
kind of amazing that you don't have. I mean, I'm looking at James Joyce. He should be in this category because this was his period. Actually, this is even post Joyce, and he was the radio effect. But boy, he gets the honor of being all the way down in the pentet category.
Right. We'll get to that. So the point is that Ezra Pound is more representative of tribal paranoia than Joyce, and that actually this quadrant, 1840 to 1900, becomes crystallized in Pound, and then LaRouche is the Android memes replay of Pound.
Okay.
So that Ezra Pound would be in the formula chart up to the satellite. He's part of the evolution of technology when humans were creating this, and then climaxes with the satellite, right? Pound, and you'll see Elliot and Lewis.
Well, he also resonates to the 1840 to 1900 in some way. I don't know if that's true. Would you say Pound resonates to the 1840-1900 period?
Yes, because he wanted to reform the Victorian and I think it's Edwardian poetry.
Yeah.
He wanted to revolutionize the British sensibility at the end of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. But then, on a more homeopathic level, satellite, right? Satellite laser beam or something. Hello.
Okay, stop the tape.
Yep.